From Nebraska to Virginia, Alabama to Montana, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Biden has announced a series of economic sanctions to counter Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. What are sanctions and what impact will they have? Christine McDaniel from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain. The Russian invasion has dramatically impacted the equity markets and will also dominate the American political scene. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. COVID fatigue has set in, and most Americans have already returned to normal life, although government has not. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And Lenin referred to those in the West who took an appeasement approach to the Soviet Union as useful idiots. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA says there are a few useful idiots on the scene today. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. President Biden and the NATO nations have imposed the first in what will be a series of economic sanctions on Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. What are sanctions? Will they have an impact? And what will be their effect on the American consumer? Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She is here to talk about sanctions. Christine, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Christine, in reaction to the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, President Biden began imposing what appears are going to be a series of increasingly harsh sanctions, economic sanctions against Russia. What does the president mean? What do we mean by the term sanctions? What are they?
Sanctions come in a few forms. Economic sanctions are essentially tools like penalties or blockages applied to by one country on another country against some particular state. So it's trying to increase the cost of doing business, increase the cost of moving goods or services or money, or in some cases, blocking the flow of capital or goods or services.
Have sanctions been tried in other circumstances before this, and have they been really all that effective?
Oh, yes. We have a long history of economic sanctions in this country and around the world. I guess in this case, since we're talking about Russia and the United States, many people will recall the U.S. grain embargo against the Soviet Union in 1980, right? So when Soviet invaded Afghanistan in 1979, a year later, then President Carter decided to impose an embargo on U.S. grain to the Soviet Union. But the general consensus was that was fairly ineffective. The Soviets just got their grain from elsewhere, and U.S. farmers were really hurt in the process.
Taking a look at the current set of sanctions, Christine, tell us a little bit about what the president has done so far, and does he have additional sanctions, additional options that he can put on the table?
Well, yes. When the U.S. and the EU announced their initial sanctions earlier in the week, the response from many was that, well, it was fairly weak. But I think the key there is that it was just the first wave, and you'll hear the U.S. administration and the Europeans using this word tranche. You know, this is just our first tranche. And so it does seem like they have a lot in reserve. They have a lot in the tank, but this is just the first wave. And the U.S. and the EU have coordinated pretty closely on this, where they're trying to target Russian individuals and entities that they believe are working to enable the invasion. So this means that there are state entities and particular individuals. I mean, the U.S. sanctions include the Russian Central Bank, the Russian Ministry of Finance, and the Russian State Wealth Fund. So, you know, that's a pretty solid start. The idea is with these full blocking sanctions on these large Russian financial institutions, you are essentially working to cut off Russia's government from Western finance, right? So keeping them from being able to raise money from the West, and then not allowing them to trade on, you know, on any new debt or use the U.S. or European markets to make money. And I do think the close coordination between the U.S. and the EU was a bit of a surprise to many here and possibly a surprise to Putin, because you are going to need that really close coordination for economic sanctions to be effective. With today, capital flows across borders in many cases seamlessly, and illicit actors have gotten very good at laundering money. In fact, there are these contract companies in Eastern Europe and Russia who will help you to move your money in illicit ways and they hope it's invisible ways. So they've gotten really good at it. So that means the U.S. and the EU need to work really closely and need to have really good intelligence to be able to target sanctions effectively.
These sanctions, of course, are meant to hurt Putin and hurt Russia. However, we do have an issue, Christine, with the fact that much of Europe is dependent on natural gas supplies from Russia. We already have had a run-up in the cost of a barrel of oil. We've had a run-up at the pump here in this country. Is this a case of where the U.S. consumer is also going to have to sacrifice and pay more as a result of these sanctions?
Not. I mean, the whole idea behind targeted economic sanctions is to maximize the penalty for the bad actors and minimize the pain for everyone else. You know, that even includes minimizing the pain for the Russian citizens, but obviously also minimizing any adverse effects for the U.S. economy and U.S. households. In terms of energy prices, I mean, we are facing higher energy prices regardless of the invasion and the sanctions. So I kind of think that's the least of our worries now. In terms of the pipeline between Russia and Europe, Nord Stream 2, that has not gone online yet. So that is really not an issue in terms of supply. And Europe is facing higher energy prices, and the whole world is on track to face higher energy prices over the next year or two. Largely, you know, when Asia comes out of its pandemic and they are going to want to start traveling again, that alone is enough to increase world energy prices. So I don't think right now the Ukraine issue is the determining factor in energy prices.
The Biden administration, of course, has been waging a war on fossil fuels. They've shut down the pipeline from Canada. We've gone from being energy independent to being, again, a net importer. Is this an opportunity, Christine, for the administration and Congress to reexamine our energy policy, because we don't want to be dependent on these foreign sources, which, as the current instance proves, are undependable?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You don't want to choose your allies carefully, and people are still scratching their head on why in the world Europe would want to rely on Putin for energy, unless there's some weird other reason there that it could be a two-way street. I mean, after all, Nord Stream 2 would be a huge stream of very significant revenue and legitimate revenue for Putin. So that leverage could go two ways. But that's the importance of diversifying our energy sources. You never want to be overly reliant on any one supplier. And to the extent we can supply it ourselves here at home, you know, all the better.
Christine McDaniel is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, that, of course, at George Mason University. Christine, if you would, tell us just a little bit about the Mercatus Center. Also, you have written on this and other subjects. Where can folks find that information online?
The Mercatus Center, we're at George Mason University. It's mercatus.org. Mercatus is Latin for market. So we're sort of a market-based, free market research institute. My pieces are all on our website as well as Forbes.com.
Christine McDaniel from the Mercatus Center. Christine, thank you again for being here.
Thank you so much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's in Washington, D.C., keeping an eye on all of the developments in Russia and the Ukraine, especially now that the invasion has begun. We're going to talk about the impact politically and on the markets. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Of course, Putin has begun the invasion. This is going to be something that's going to weigh heavily for a number of weeks, months, maybe even years. So, Scott, first of all, the political impact of this domestically. What does this do to President Biden? What does it do politically to all the races we have for U.S. Senate and congressional seats this year?
Well, let's first of all keep in mind that the Republican Party is actually pretty fractured when it comes to our national security and national defense positions. President Trump certainly readjusted the foreign policy and national security approach that the United States employs. And within our party, a lot of folks have taken on sort of not necessarily a dovish posture, but they're not the defense hawks of John McCain and George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney that are leading the party anymore. And so a lot of folks are quite apprehensive about the United States getting involved militarily. And I know that one of your other guests on the program is talking about the economic sanctions that are being employed by the Biden administration. What the result is right now is you've got all eyes within Washington, D.C., seeing exactly what steps Vladimir Putin is going to be taking, whether or not he's willing to go beyond Ukraine and get involved in territory from Poland or Lithuania or other NATO allies. And so I think that the markets are clearly paying attention. For the last month, actually for the last 4 or 5 months, we've watched this buildup happen along the Ukrainian border from Russian troops and assets. And I think that that's been a large reason why the stock markets have been pretty jittery over the last couple of months. We've seen this week the Dow futures tumbling on the heels of the invasion, and everybody's been watching what's been happening with cryptocurrencies. That's not just a reaction to what happened in Canada regarding banks, but I think it's a reality of the interconnectedness of currency that is not based in any currency from a country like the dollar. So we're clearly in the middle of all this right now, and what Congress is going to be doing next is probably an emergency supplemental to look at what's needed in Ukraine and around our allies to support that area.
In terms of the political impact here, Scott, Joe Biden's job approval rating continued to sink well before this invasion actually got underway. He, of course, ran as a candidate who had vast foreign policy experience. We would caveat that by saying that much of his foreign policy experience was not very effective and certainly errant in many different ways. Is this going to be a defining challenge for the Biden presidency?
I think everything that Joe Biden has been touching has sort of had negative consequences over the last 14 months. The country is so divided. He lost his honeymoon period pretty quickly when it comes to governing style. They obviously pushed a really partisan stimulus package that passed along party line vote last March. Then we've seen the debacle from the withdrawal in Afghanistan when 13 of our men and women serving in the Marine Corps, and I believe one was an Army medic, were killed outside the airport there in Afghanistan. We've obviously watched inflation destroy wage growth within the United States, and this has been a real economic setback to the so-called economic boom that we had for really 3 full years underneath Donald Trump, and then that was pretty much hit a roadblock with the coronavirus pandemic. So I think that Joe Biden and what he's doing here in Ukraine, he seems quite incompetent. His leadership style and the Democrats' leadership style when it comes to national security and national affairs has always been a position of weakness. And that doesn't mean that the United States is never going to get in another skirmish abroad, right, with America First policies that Trump was championing. But it meant that we would certainly protect any of the economic assets that we've got abroad and that we'd also fulfill the commitments that we've got with our allies. Now, we've seen Joe Biden give press conferences and other remarks over the past week. He does not appear to be leading from any position of strength. And when America is perceived to be weak, that's when you have these actors like Vladimir Putin take advantage of the political situation, and he right now is basically testing the waters, I think, with the anecdote of Ukraine to see what else he might be able to do, because Vladimir Putin's not going anywhere. I don't think anybody expects Joe Biden to outlast Vladimir Putin. And so when you've got a vacuum of power in the international community, it's going to take a significant coalition of allies to step up and get in front of this. I just don't think that Joe Biden has the appetite to do it, and the American people are also kind of questioning what exactly are the American interests as it pertains to Ukraine.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, a few words about the club.
Yeah, Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. Our group is united in those ideas of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity. Anybody can join for free on our website, clubforgrowth.org, and you can also check us out on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, and we will check in with you next week, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you.
Public opinion has clearly turned against COVID-19 pandemic restrictions as most Americans have now returned to normal life. But government policy lags. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explains.
7 out of 10 Americans say it's time that we accept COVID is here to stay and we just need to get on with our lives. That's according to a new poll, and it's a poll that politicians are definitely starting to notice. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. You know, it takes a lot to make a libertarian like me look forward, hopefully, to the next election. Like, say, 2 years of miserable government mandates ignored by some of the very people who have imposed them. Or like watching over 70,000 maskless adults and many celebrities partying at the Super Bowl that was held in a city where children are required to wear medical-grade masks to school and keep them on even while playing outdoor sports. Or like imposing border controls on immigration and travel that were meant to stop the spread of COVID-19 and then keeping them in place with no discernible off-ramp long after the virus is spreading here in America and has been spreading indeed for months now, the Omicron variant. For once, however, I find that even somebody like me, who doesn't really look forward to elections too often, can be quite thankful that another election season is already upon us, because politics is pretty much the last realm where the pandemic is still dominating decision-making. The economy came out of the Omicron wave in better shape than expected, according to all the sorts of data that we get from the Department of Labor and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The Super Bowl earlier this month, I thought, was a terrific signal that culturally and socially, most Americans, even those who live in places like California, are just done with the health theatrics of the past 2 years. If you watched the game, you didn't see many people wearing masks in the audience. Maybe not even 20% masked. But even the political class's commitment to COVID policy is now starting to waver. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and President Joe Biden might be refusing to offer much hope that COVID-related mandates will be lifted soon, but they are increasingly at odds with rank-and-file Democrats who are looking at favorability ratings that are falling nearly as fast as COVID case counts. In New York, for example, Governor Kathy Hochul announced last week that businesses will no longer be required to enforce masking of unvaccinated customers. California's indoor mask mandate will expire this week, even though some local governments will keep similar rules in place. Schools everywhere are finally easing up on mask rules that never made much sense, since children are generally not at risk of serious illness from COVID. Connecticut's school masking mandate will end next week at the end of February. New Jersey's will follow suit on March 7th. Delaware is going to end its mask mandate at the end of March. And in all three cases, those are orders that came from Democratic governors in blue states, an acknowledgement that even in places where some of the strictest COVID policies have been in place now for going on 2 years, those policies are beginning to come off the books. People are just tired of them, even in blue states. But I think maybe the most telling example of this sentiment sweeping the country came from the state where I live, in Virginia, earlier this month, where the Democratic-controlled state Senate voted 29-9. 2 weeks ago, to let parents decide whether their kids wear masks in school, regardless of what policies local school boards might have in place. Given how closely support for mask mandates have mapped onto partisan alliances over the past year or so, that is a resoundingly bipartisan statement. 29-9 was the vote in the Senate. A few days later, the State House also passed the bill with bipartisan support, sending it to Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's desk, and he is expected to sign it. Look, politics are always downstream of culture, and all democratic systems are ultimately grounded in the will of the people. So that means there's a sort of feedback mechanism for those in power. you get elected and then you can do pretty much whatever you want. But eventually, every 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, you have to face the voters again. And if you've done things that they don't like, well, that doesn't go well for you generally. The pandemic helped expose some of what happens when that feedback system gets disrupted, because it was governors in a lot of states relying on emergency powers that cut the legislature out of the pandemic rulemaking process. And yes, governors are elected just like state lawmakers, but it's a bit different. Governors, because there's only one for the whole state, are just a little bit more removed from the will of the people. Now, some might argue that that's a benefit, not a flaw, that government must respond to a crisis quickly and there might not be time for legislative deliberation we need. And that's true up to a point, but I think 2 years in, it's pretty clear that we're no longer in a crisis. We're in a situation that can be addressed via the regular functioning of democratic government. COVID might still be a serious public health problem, but it's no longer a public health emergency, is what I'm saying. And when the system is allowed to work as intended and policymakers have to face re-election on a regular basis, as state lawmakers do, then those policymakers have a strong incentive to go along with the desired will of the people. For example, by voting against mandatory masking in school, as what happened in Virginia. But you don't have to look at what the politicians are doing. What you really should do is look at what the polls are saying. A survey from Monmouth University released on the last day of January found that 70% of Americans and 47% of Democrats agreed with the statement that it is time, we accept COVID is here to stay, and we just need to get on with our lives. That same poll found that support for vaccine mandates has dropped by 10% since September of last year, while support for social distancing requirements was down 11% over the same period. And those trends seem likely to only grow and accelerate as the Omicron variant vanishes into the rearview mirror and warmer weather arrives across much of the country. Now, we should at least consider the possibility that these changes in COVID policy are being driven by, as they say, following the science. Case counts, after all, are falling, and the promise of warmer weather is right around the corner in much of the country, which should also help mitigate the spread. Maybe Democrats aren't playing politics at all and are just adjusting strategies as the circumstances dictate, right? Well, I'm skeptical of that conclusion. Joe Biden doesn't have to face re-election until 2024, and the CDC never has to go before the voters. And it's those federal entities that are doing the least right now to roll back pandemic-era rules. But state and local lawmakers are being much more responsive to the emerging will of the people, who are increasingly indicating, both in polls and their general behavior, like we saw at the Super Bowl, that they've had enough of masking and restrictions, that this pandemic, at least the emergency phase of the pandemic, has to finally come to an end. And you know what? That's the democratic system working as it is intended. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of the upcoming midterms and the pandemic and everything else going on around the country at Reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
History tells us that appeasement of dictators never works. Yet there are, as Lenin once said, useful idiots willing to go that route today. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The term useful idiots to describe communist sympathizers in the West is often attributed to Vladimir Lenin. While the Soviets held them in utter disdain, they also viewed them as tools for advancing the communist agenda. That's why they were useful. That's also why they were idiots. It's a term dripping with contempt for persons who promote or support a cause or a person, typically a strongman leader, without fully comprehending the causes or strongman's goals. In the run-up to the Second World War, Hitler saw Chamberlain as a useful idiot. Listen to Chamberlain's speech to the House of Commons in this slightly condensed version. I would like to remind the House of two things. The first is this. We did not go to Munich to decide whether the predominantly German areas in the Sudetenland area of Czechoslovakia should be passed over to the German Reich. That had been decided already. The second point to remember is that all the elements were present on the spot for the outbreak of a conflict which might have precipitated a catastrophe. There were considerable quantities of arms. Therefore, it was essential that we should quickly reach a conclusion so that this painful and difficult operation of territorial transfer might be carried out at the earliest possible moment, in order that we might avoid the possibility of something that might have rendered all our attempts at peaceful solution useless. It is my hope and my belief that the new Czechoslovakia will find a greater security than she has ever enjoyed in the past. Chamberlain went on, I would like to say a few words in respect of the various other participants besides ourselves in the Munich Agreement. After everything that has been said about the German Chancellor today and in the past, I do feel that the House ought to recognize the difficulty for a man in that position to take back such emphatic declarations as he had already made amidst the enthusiastic cheers of his supporters, and to recognize that in consenting, even though it were only at the last moment, to discuss with the representatives of other powers those things which he had declared he had already decided once for all, was a real and substantial contribution on his part. In my view, the strongest force of all was that unmistakable sense of unanimity among the peoples of the world that war must somehow be averted. That is the end of Chamberlain's speech, and I quoted at some length from it because I think it would be good for us to listen for echoes of his weakness and appeasement in the remarks of our contemporary American and European leaders. Hitler disregarded Chamberlain and proceeded to use his military forces to overwhelm all of Czechoslovakia, not just the Sudetenland, the small part of Czechoslovakia that he claimed initially was culturally German. How likely do you think it is that Putin is similarly disregarding Biden, Macron, and Scholz today? How likely is it that he will move on from the relatively small, culturally Russian areas known as the Donbass? As of Wednesday last week, he had already begun that move, claiming the entirety of the two provinces Donetsk and Luhansk. Who thinks he will stop there when he continues to assert that all of Ukraine is not a real nation, but rather a part of cultural Russia and the old Soviet Union, whose dissolution he memorably called the greatest tragedy of the 20th century? So the question for the patriotic listeners of American Radio Journal is this: is President Biden showing himself to be a student of history and avoiding being lured into making the utterances of a useful idiot? Are sanctions enough to deter Vladimir Putin, or will he simply scoff at them as the ineffective tools of a weak leader? The president is correct in stating that he does not want American troops to fight Russian troops in Ukraine, but has he done all he could do in providing military hardware to President Zelensky for the defense of Ukraine? And what does former President Trump's praise of Putin's strategy as genius and savvy sound like? The parallels between Czechoslovakia 80 years ago and Ukraine today are striking, as are the parallels between Hitler and Putin. Isn't it ironic that a term associated with another strongman, Stalin, should also apply so closely to the current situation? As you watch this confrontation continue to build, be alert to the sounds of useful idiots. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KTRU-FM in La Harpe, Kansas, WENG-AM and FM in Englewood, Florida, along with WQSU-FM in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.